Welcome to Caring on the Go, your exclusive access to the latest news and commentary from the current issue of Caring for the Ages, the official newspaper of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Statements made by guests on this podcast are their own opinions and are not necessarily the positions of the Society. A speaker's appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them, their views, or any entity they represent. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host of Caring on the Go, Dr. Carl Steinberg.
Hello, and welcome to Caring on the Go for our March 2024 issue. And we're excited to be heading to the AMDA annual meeting in San Antonio next week. I'm your host and editor-in-chief emeritus of Caring for the Ages, Dr. Carl Steinberg. Caring on the Go, a member of the AMDA on the Go podcast series, spotlights articles and stories from Caring for the Ages, the news magazine from AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. With every new issue, we feature Caring for the Ages editor-in-chief, Dr. Elizabeth Gallick, to discuss some key articles in this episode highlighting our March issue of Caring. Dr. Gallick is a nurse practitioner in long-term care and community-based settings through a clinical practice within the Shepherd Pratt Health System. She's a professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing, where she teaches in the Adult Gerontology Primary Care Nurse Practitioner Program and conducts research to improve care practices for older adults with dementia and their caregivers in long-term care. Beth, welcome back to Caring on the Go.
Thanks, Carl. I'm so glad to be here with you again today.
All righty. So we'll kick off today's session talking about the lead article from page one of the March issue of Caring by the late, great Dr. Steve Levinson, a past AMDA president and a true giant in post-acute and long-term care, you know, with many decades of service to our organization, who died recently. And this was a great loss to our society and so many of us, including, I'm sure, many of our listeners, whom he mentored and guided along our respective paths. So this article, published posthumously, is titled Medical Aid in Dying Laws, The Hidden Conflicts and Controversies. And before we start, I'll just let our listeners know, and some of you might recall, that Dr. Gallick and I have differing opinions on this topic. And I live in practice in California, where medical aid in dying is a legal option, while Beth is in Maryland, where it isn't, although there's again been legislation introduced in 2024 to change that. And I'll also preface the discussion by mentioning that only a tiny percentage of deaths by medical aid in dying occur in nursing homes in any of the 11 jurisdictions where it's currently legal in the U.S. So, Beth, what were your key points for our listeners from this article, and what issues does it bring up? And, you know, I know Steve was also from Maryland, and you and he were really close. You wrote a beautiful tribute to him on page 10 of this issue. So if you want to share a few words about Steve first, that would be lovely.
Thanks, Carl. I have to tell you, I really miss Steve and find myself imagining advice that he would give to me as it relates to care of older adults based on some of our previous conversations. He was always one for a good phone call about once a month and helped me with some things. And while I had been familiar with Steve because we were both in the Mid-Atlantic chapter of AMDA, it took me a while to really get to know him. You know, I knew about his unwavering dedication for older adults and post-acute and long-term care and AMDA. But it wasn't until I got to be editor-in-chief of Caring for the Ages and he became a regular columnist for us that I really got to know him a little bit better. And there were a lot of nuances to Steve that I didn't fully appreciate until I was able to work with him more closely. He was an expert diagnostician, loved teaching staff, anybody who would was interested, how to access reliable medical information, how to do a good internet search. He was an early leader in AMDA and received a lot of honors. And he also really, once you got to know him, had a great sense of humor. He had worked very carefully on this column and, you know, I think just wanted people to be aware of some of the less obvious concerns about medical aid in dying laws, not so much the practice of it, but the laws. And Steve had a regulatory background and had regulatory concerns about MADE laws in some states, particularly as it related to the lack of monitoring and oversight beyond what we do in standard medical care. So a few of his points I'd like to share. In order to protect patient privacy, many of the laws in states limit adequate investigation, disclosure, and discovery. So there can be challenges in confirming whether or not these required procedures were actually done correctly and whether the patient met the criteria that were set forth. An example of this is that in many states, death certificates do not list MADE as a cause of death. It lists the underlying illness.
Yeah, I think all of the states, actually, Beth, I don't think there's any state where you actually write down person died of, poly medication overdose or anything like that.
So, with that, it makes it somewhat challenging to track. He also worried about practitioner skill in doing key things that must be done in order to safeguard patients as they go through this process. And he highlighted them in terms of accurate diagnosis, accurate prognosis, which we all know can be a little challenging in many circumstances. Determining decision-making capacity and determining undue influence or coercion. In terms of the decision-making capacity, I guess it was about a year ago, I asked Damien Doyle and Howard Solins to write an article for Caring that focused on the assessment of decision-making capacity. And Damien said to me, you know what, Beth, nobody's going to read this. Everybody knows how to do this. And I said, you know what, Damien, you're going to be surprised. And in 2023, it was our second most downloaded article.
Yeah, it's a truly important skill. Yeah,
yep. So,
I'm very glad you asked for that article.
Yeah, me too. And this week alone, I had about three different nurse practitioners, because in Maryland now, nurse practitioners can determine capacity. Ask me, how do you do this? I never learned this in school. They had been out practicing for a while. So and in most states, I don't know if there's actually any where NPs can do MADE, but regardless, I think that there's many chances where errors could happen. And Steve just really, I think, wanted us to be aware for that. And in the end, Steve's main point was that as providers, we can really provide compassionate and effective care at end of life. And with palliative care processes that are widespread and have, in cases shown to be very effective. So those were just a couple of his thoughts. And, we've had a lot of articles and we've discussed in podcasts before about MADE and a lot of the advantages. And I felt like this at least would get people thinking about, if you're going to do this, how to be good at it. In other words, how to really make sure that you're careful.
Yeah. And I thought Steve brought up a lot of great points in the article. And certainly, like anything, things can be done well and things can be done not so well. I think most of the states do have pretty significant safeguards in place. And actually, there are a couple of jurisdictions where nurse practitioners and PAs are now able to prescribe the lethal medications. So there's a resolution that we'll be taking up at the AMDA House of Delegates in San Antonio that proposes to retire our 1997 policy. That's the last time it was ever addressed, that basically categorically opposed any participation in physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia, and, in my opinion, bring us in line with more person-centered and modern-day sensibilities, and we'll see how that fares. But that argument about with good palliative care, this should never be necessary, that's easy for somebody to say as a clinician, but as a patient who maybe does not want to go through their glioblastoma having intractable seizures and fecal incontinence and, putting their family through that, good palliative care doesn't solve that problem. So anyway, we don't need to get into the nuances of it. And it's clearly not for everyone. But, if it's a legal option, as a physician who does palliative care, I feel like, you know, I want to walk the path with my patient wherever it takes them within reason. And for me, that's within reason. For other doctors, it might not be, or other clinicians. So anyway, great discussion. And thank you for getting Steve to write that. And I do think it brings up some real thought-provoking stuff.
Well, actually, Steve came up with that concept on his own,
but
worked closely with Tess and I, you know, to make sure that, you know, it could be something that people of varying opinions could, at least, if they didn't agree with it, hear it. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and honestly, when you check out on the death certificate and you completely ignore the actual immediate cause of death, that does feel a little uncomfortable, right? But that's what the law directs us to do. We like to follow the law.
It would for me. The other piece I just wanted to chime in there is about feeling a burden on your family members. That's one that I particularly am concerned about people feeling, whether or not it's real or not, but people feeling pressure to not put their family members through things.
Right, and even if it's self-imposed.
Exactly. Yeah. And those are the areas that just make me a little bit nervous. So I think it's going to be an interesting and lively discussion. I can certainly appreciate there's situations in which MAID can be appropriate. It's not something that I would be comfortable engaging in at this point. But I really worry about those less clear-cut cases where prognosis, capacity, and the potential coercive influence of others may not be fully explored or vetted.
Yeah, I share your concern about people. And I've cared for patients who basically have said, I want to end my life because I don't want to use up my kids' inheritance. That makes me very, very uncomfortable, right?
Yeah.
That to me doesn't seem like a reason. Although,
exactly.
Consider autonomy. I mean, if I guess they're allowed to do whatever they want with their body, but if they have a terminal condition. But anyway, all right. Well, thank you.
we could spend all day on this, couldn't we?
We don't want to have a 3-hour-long podcast, right? All right. So our next article is going to be from Below the Fold on page 1 by Nancy Zients, and I hope that I pronounce it right, entitled How Nursing Home Leadership Strengthens the Workforce Pipeline Through the Teaching Nursing Home Collaborative. And this is such an important topic, considering that many nursing programs, you know, nursing schools include little to no exposure to art care settings. And as you and I and many of our listeners know, it's easy for people to have a negative bias against nursing facilities if you've never been in one. You know, the only thing you ever see on TV is always, you know, horrible stuff in the media. And clearly, nursing homes are not for everyone as far as a place they'd like to work. But for a lot of us, once we've seen the love and grace and compassion that are given every day in nursing homes, and what a unique and colorful care setting and population we have, we kind of get hooked. So the more we can get people of all professional designations into nursing homes, the better, you know, because it's gonna you know, weed out people who don't want to work there, but select for people who do. So, Beth, what did you want to be sure our listeners and readers got from this piece?
So I really enjoyed this article because I think it was a nice call to action for those of us who are working in post-acute and long-term care settings, that we really need to do our parts as leaders to become more actively involved in exposing future staff and practitioners to these settings through a teaching nursing home, having clinical groups come, bringing trainees in, however we want to do it. And there were a couple of points that I just want to highlight. Really needing to break down barriers and obstacles to having students and trainees come in. I will just briefly share this one story. At the School of Nursing where I work, our entry into practice students were much more highly engaged in having post-acute long-term care rotations until COVID. And following, and they were quickly told to leave, and trying to get students back into those settings was quite difficult. And so what ended up is it was easier to get them in the hospitals, and that's where they went. And so now trying to reconfigure this has been a challenge. The other thing is being good at the basics. So teaching age-friendly healthcare, and if you're going to bring people into your facilities, make sure you're good at the basics. Mobility, medications, mentation, and what matters. Those are the things that, you know, I think really can make a difference in terms of a rehab stay, in terms of a long-term care stay. And it's something that students and trainees can remember. So just some ideas of, rather than just always talking about we don't have enough people, reach out to schools of medicine, schools of nursing, schools of social work that are near you. Make those connections, widen your professional network, and try to bring folks into your facilities.
Yep. I think that's great advice for our listeners, and to those who do have any kind of connections or influence with some of these institutions, please use those, you know, get with your administration and figure out a way to make it work. And it doesn't have to be a whole passel of people coming in. It can even be little onesies, twosies, people shadowing, but let's just get them into our buildings. You know, we took a resolution to the AMA a couple of years ago where we asked them to support a requirement of some time in medical school and in primary care residencies in the post-acute and or long-term care setting. And unfortunately, it got watered down to just say, it got passed, but it got watered down to say, we recommend this, you know, to medical schools and residency programs. So I haven't heard of a lot of people changing their policies, but yeah, let's try to get people in our buildings. So
one more little thing I'm going to share. In our adult gerontology nurse practitioner program, most of our students who enter it the vast majority of them don't see a career in geriatrics when they enter, but when they graduate, roughly a third of them go in to post-acute and long-term care.
Wow, so, fantastic, Beth. You're doing a good job over there. Keep that up.
Yeah. Just that exposure makes such a difference.
Yep. And honestly, that does not surprise me one bit. So yeah, let's try to get everybody on the same page and bring more people in. They're pretty magical places, you know, even if they aren't Disneyland, as I always like to say. All right. So next, we're going to talk about your Caring Collaborative column on page 2, titled In the Thick of It, How to Survive as a Caregiver of an Aging Relative. And Beth, I want to thank you for sharing this deeply personal piece about your own family's journey, which I understand, you know, has gone further since this was written. And I hope you know that it really resonates with me, and I'm sure with many of our readers and listeners. So please tell us a little bit about your experience and what lessons there might be for our listeners.
Family caregiving impacts so many more of us than I think we actually know about. Depending on what you read, somewhere between 37 and 42 million in the United States. And unfortunately, we don't really talk about it very much. There are good things associated with it, and you may hear that. But nobody really talks about the challenges unless they're doing it with their closest friends. But things are not widely known. And as healthcare providers who are also caregivers, I think many of us assume that we'll be naturally good at this as we help others with this all of the time. But when it's your own family involved, I think you lose a little bit of your perspective sometimes, and it can make it more challenging. I've discovered that, you know, for me personally, I've set many unrealistic expectations for myself, and something that others who have been in healthcare roles have shared with me as well. So a few themes from the article. One is be prepared. So before crises emerge, really focusing like we would with our patients on that advanced care planning, and also attention to how would financial resources be accessed if the individual couldn't do it anymore, but needed care. So not just when you pass away, but when you might be incapacitated. And then the last two points, really letting caregivers know that you're not going to be able to do this by yourself. So it's important to accept help and not feel guilty about it. And trying your best to involve some self-care. Be kind, forgive yourself. Making sure you're trying to get sleep when you can, that you're eating reasonably well, that you're doing periodic things that you enjoy, because caregiving really can become all-consuming. And knowing that we're, you know, as clinicians, we're often thinking about how we can fix and solve problems. And unfortunately, in some of these situations, there's some things that we really can't fix, and giving ourselves permission to do the best we can to support quality of life, but knowing that it, you know, we're all not here permanently.
Yep. Yep. That is great advice on so many levels. And I hope our readers and listeners take that to heart. And yeah, you know, it just for me and my role, you know, with family members who've been ill or nearing the end of life, one thing is, as clinicians, we want to be the clinician. We want to be the doctor or what have you. And sometimes that's, I mean, sometimes it's good, but sometimes it's not good. So just want to put that out there. I don't know if you've had that experience also.
Absolutely. And I've also had the experience of really not wanting to be the clinician, but having other people feel like I should be.
Yes. Yes.
And
complicated, right?
It's pretty complicated. Yeah. But, you know, we go along and do the best we can day to day. And, yeah, you know, I would like to think that, you know, in the end, it might make me a better provider in the long run.
That's just what I was going to say. Yeah. And you know, I think when we see family members whom we might consider as difficult, you know, when we're doing patient care, I think it's good to step back and just say, you know what, this person just doing, they're doing it from a place of love, at least, you know, a great majority of the time. So, so thanks again for sharing that, Beth. It's really meaningful. And for those of us who've been through similar experiences, I think despite the heartache and trauma associated with being in that role, it really may have a side benefit of making us better, more compassionate, and more empathic clinicians. So thank you. So we'll wrap up by discussing an article from page 3 of the March issue by Drs. Mark Tolles and Singh Pallett. And this one's called Caregivers, the Secret Sauce in Care Transitions. I like that, secret sauce, right? Because who doesn't like secret sauce? Although I haven't had a Big Mac in probably 30 years, but I did used to like it. Anyway, it's such an important topic, or really two important topics, right? Transitions of care and caregivers. So Beth, what are the lessons we can learn from this piece?
Sure. So in terms of caregiving, I loved how the authors really gave voice to the unspoken questions of caregivers. Most specifically, the question that I think, particularly as people are leaving an acute care setting and going on a journey that may have a post-acute stay, may have a long-term care stay following it, may be going home with home care, how am I going to do all of this? It rarely gets asked. And as clinicians, I think we need to do a better job of acknowledging this and trying. We're not going to be able to solve all the problems, but doing our best to resource family caregivers as, you know, while they're in our setting and as they leave. Our social work colleagues, we can look to them. They're quite excellent at this, but they can't do it alone, particularly while they're doing the host of other things that they do so well, such as coordinating discharges and appointments and getting medical equipment and addressing behavioral health and, you know, et cetera. We all need to really be involved with our family caregivers. I also liked that there was an emphasis on engaging caregivers in medication reconciliation, particularly when there's been multiple transitions. And I know in my most recent experience with my family, I was glad that I asked about medicines and asked to look at the list to make sure, because I picked up on probably about 3 errors.
Wow.
Over the course of 1, 2, 3 transitions. So, and, you know, My parent in that instance didn't have a really complicated regimen. And so it's kind of shocking how errors can happen.
Right.
The third point really discussed about having rehab be part of the team and having them work with family caregivers, because people don't know how to transfer individuals necessarily or how to motivate them to engage in physical activity. So getting our rehab colleagues involved, because they're so good at this.
Right.
And then lastly, I'm not going to spoil it because Dr. Singh Palat and her colleagues are going to do a presentation on this at the conference, but there was a great section on micro transitions. So that's kind of like small little transitions, like moving a room within a facility or going out to a medical appointment or a trip, and how those things can impact residents when they have a change in environment.
Yeah, good stuff. And, you know, what you said about medications, I can't tell you how often, you know, these last 20 years or so, I've made it a habit to, when I get a new admission, pick up the phone and call the family. And it is remarkable how often we find out that the med list we got, either there's something significant missing, or something's been added that maybe didn't need to be added, like a PPI, let's say, or something. And so I do think that's a very good practice to bring in family members. Plus, family members really appreciate it when they get called by somebody who's looking after their loved one.
They really do. I can speak from that on personal experience. The other piece is, while electronic medical records have made some things easier, it's also, I think, gotten us a little lazy. It's easy in some of these systems, particularly in acute care, to pull in med lists that often are not coming from the post-acute or long-term care environment, but are coming maybe from a primary care provider's office that may not be up to date.
Right, or from a prior hospitalization.
Exactly.
Yeah, all the time.
It happens all the time. And it's just something really to be sensitive to and to be on the lookout for.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, thank you for that. And thanks to all the caregivers among our listeners. We've had a lot of talk about that today. And yeah, right. There's three kind of people. There's caregivers, people who are cared for by caregivers, or people who will eventually be caregivers. Was that Rosalind Carter? I don't know, somebody like that.
It was Rosalind Carter, yeah.
And, you know, for those who aren't caregivers, please remember to give your thanks to those who are, because they really do such important work. Anyway, we're close to the end. I wanted to mention there's, as usual, so much additional great content in this issue, Beth, including our Dear Dr. Diane column by Diane Sanders-Cepeda on page 4. This one boasts one of my favorite titles ever in caring. Whoppy alert, we need more cowbell. I hope you think that's as good as I do.
Yeah, it goes back to more cowbell with Will Ferrell and my gosh, I can't remember his
name. It was Christopher Walken, I think.
That's it.
That just put a huge smile on my face.
And Diane's writing of this will give you almost as many smiles as that SNL skit did.
Yeah. So there's an excellent legal issues piece from our lawyer friend, Alan Horowitz, about fall prevention and liability. A couple of items on pets and pet therapy, which has always been a favorite topic of mine, from senior reporter Joanne Caldi. There's a good piece on delirium, and really a lovely piece on page 11 from Dr. Colin Burks about grief and death in nursing homes, which I think we sometimes don't give enough sort of intentional weight to, you know, where we just act like residents' deaths are business as usual. But, you know, in reality, these are sacred events involving people that we and our staff care about. And these losses really should be acknowledged as such, and encourage all of our listeners to figure out ways to acknowledge it and, feel grief together when our patients die. So, Beth, before we close, any final comments or wisdom to share on these or any other articles you particularly liked?
Well, I just wanted to say that this was one of my favorite issues recently. You know, I thought it had a lot of great and diverse content. Another thing I want to share is we feature in Caring partner perspectives where different organizations with shared interests provide some information about their organization's goals they're working on. And the assisted living special interest group committee, I'm not sure what we're calling it, but they've been very busy this year having a lot of assisted living articles in Caring, and had the American Assisted Living Nurses Association submit a piece about their organization. So if you're working in assisted living, you might want to give it a you know, check it out, particularly if you're a nurse.
Well, great. So that's going to wrap it up for the March 2024 Caring on the Go podcast. Under the leadership of Editor-in-Chief, Dr. Elizabeth Gallick, Associate Editor, Dr. Jerry Winokur, and Managing Editor, Dr. Tess Bird, Caring for the Ages continues to report and highlight the outstanding work being done by AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine, and its leaders, members, and communities. Please take a look at this jam-packed 20-page kickoff issue. Whoops, it's not the kickoff issue, our spring issue of 2024, available as always without a paywall at www.caringfortheages.com. And please recommend and share Caring with your friends and colleagues. Meanwhile, thanks to our listeners for your support and for the wonderful work you do every day. Thanks again to Dr. Gallick for spending your time with Caring on the Go.
Thanks, Carl. It was so good to be with you again. And for our listeners, please consider following Caring for the Ages on Instagram or on LinkedIn.
Yes. And I hope we'll see many of our readers and listeners, or if this is already after, I hope we did see you at our meeting in San Antonio. And please let us know what you like about our podcast and our news magazine, and also what you think we could do better. So now, until next time, I'm Dr. Carl Steinberg for Caring on the Go.
If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, visit paltc.org/podcast.